something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay.
And me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to a Cross Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and I want to share with you a modern legend.
Okay.
You've probably heard this one before. It's one of the most persistent rumors of the modern age. The L. Ron Hubbard, Robert A. Heinlein bar bet.
Ah, yes.
You know this one, Robert.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I looked into it, and I couldn't find any convincing evidence that this bet ever actually took place, so it's probably just more of a legend than a real historical account. But the legend I always heard goes something like this. You've got L. Ron Hubbard and Robert A. Heinlein, two science fiction authors of the 20th century, and they're sitting in a bar.
Whoa, they don't walk into a bar?
I suppose they have to walk into the bar first. If they don't take hoverboards. Or maybe they power armor stamp into the bar.
Okay.
But anyway, they're in the bar, they're down in some brewskis, and this is probably sometime, I would guess, in the late 1940s, and they are discussing the best way to make a ton of money, because let's face it, writing science fiction doesn't always pay amazingly.
Right. And at this point in both the men's career, they are sci-fi writers.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So Hubbard has an opinion. L. Ron Hubbard says, you know, the best strategy is really to take advantage of the common people's desire for transcendence and salvation. So he says, quote, religion. That's where the real money is. And Hubbard boasts that he could invent a religion and make millions. Of course, Heinlein balks at this. This sounds kind of extravagant. So they make a bet. Can he do it? Can he not do it? And by the end of the century, there are at least tens of thousands of Scientologists in the world. The Church of Scientology claims millions of adherents. Those numbers, who knows what the real numbers are, but it seems like at least tens of thousands. And Scientology is the sci-fi religion founded on the teachings of L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah, and it has official religious status in numerous countries. So even though this bet probably did not take place, like, it's one of those things where, yes, it could have if you really crunch it, but there's absolutely no documentation.
Yeah, there's no good evidence for it. And in fact, we probably really should emphasize that, because apparently in the past, there have been some legal actions against people who promulgate this as if it were true.
Yeah.
So probably not true. But why is the rumor so persistent? Everybody's heard this, right? I bet you sitting at home or sitting standing, running, wherever you are listening, I bet you've heard some version of this before, right? So you could chalk it up to people's just general distaste for Scientology. There's a lot of antipathy out there.
Right. There's no shortage of Scientology criticism and lampooning on the internet these days.
Right. But you could also say that this kind of story sticks in the mind and merits repeating simply because of the sheer audacity of it. It offends our most basic sensibilities about what religion is and is supposed to be. Creating a religion out of thin air, just on a whim, coming up with a new religion, something about it seems fiercely wrong, just nakedly perverse.
Well, yeah, I think so. I think, on one hand, it does seem like sheer audacity that somebody would just create it wholesale. Though, of course, as we'll discuss, to a large extent, nobody creates a religion wholesale. You're building it out of existing parts. It's all kind of like that first Iron Man suit that Stark builds in the first Iron Man film. He just builds it out of all the stuff that's laying around, and then he uses that to his advantage. And that's, I think I would argue that that's what you see in most of these cases, though the particular suit of religious armor changes depending on the quality of the ingredients.
Yeah, and I would say this relates back to something we talked about in our Techno-Religion for the Masses episodes, which is that I personally think that a lot of the power we attribute to religion lies in our chronological alienation from its origins and from its contents.
I mean, it comes down to sort of like, what does someone want from a religion? What does one want from a god? They want something greater than themselves, something that stands outside of themselves. What better way than to have something that stands outside of not only your lifespan, but even your generation, outside of your era even? You know, it's calling to you from a distant place / time.
Some of the power comes from the mystery of its separation. That's sort of what holiness is. It's way less impressive if it seems to spring from the very ground we walk on from day to day.
Right.
And yet, all religions start somewhere.
It's true.
No religion can have always been ancient. Because every religion that exists today, even the one you believe in, you would have to admit has an origin. It started at some point. People started believing in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Though most are probably not the result of a single moment of creativity, whether inspired by gambling and brewskis and whatnot. I mean, they're probably from gradual evolutions of beliefs.
Right. Yeah. New ideas that suddenly get picked up by, in many cases, a charismatic individual who is bringing this to people, or, you know, it ties into to shifts and changes in the structure of society, and then in our sort of, and then when you layer over the mythic materials as well, you're going to throw in some miracles, you're going to throw in some fantastic occurrences, golden books falling out of the sky or emerging from the ground, right?
Yeah, but this is what we want to talk about today, right? So it's the beginnings of religious movements, and especially on those that draw from sources other than direct spiritual revelation. So you might have a movement that starts with somebody thinks they've received a message from God or from otherworldly powers, from a supernatural agent, and then they deliver that message and found a new religion. You've got those. But we want to talk about what happens when something that everybody recognizes as a fiction or an in-joke or a prank or a fan club takes on the mantle of religion and genuine sanctity.
Yeah, when does it become an actual religion? And I know some of you might be thinking, well, what does any of this have to do with science and the flag of science that is up there over Stuff to Blow Your Mind? Well, a lot, actually, because most of what we're going to talk about is occurring, if not right now, then at least in the scientific age.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the age of science, this age of reason, has a lot to do with the emergence of hyper-real religions.
Absolutely. And I think we would be remiss if we did not begin this discussion with one of the most popular jokes-turned religions of our modern age, and that is Pastafarianism.
Yes. And I do want to just throw in real quick, this is, of course, the word Pastafarianism is a play on Rastafarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to just point out that we are aware that adherents of the Rastafari faith often do not like the term Rastafarianism. So it's kind of like there's a little bit of insult to Rastafari adherents built into Pastafarianism.
Well, maybe for that reason we could avoid it and just say flying spaghetti monsterism.
Well, I think we can refer to either. I just thought it was important to acknowledge that yes, there's, I don't think it was intentional, but there, the Pastafarianism could be deemed offensive by some out there.
Certainly. And if you're already lost, we need to back up because in order for this to make sense, we've got to start with a brief bit of historical context, especially for those of you who live outside the United States and aren't familiar with the school creationism controversy that's gone on in the United States. I'd say mostly in the last 20 years or so, maybe 15, 20 years. So in the United States, we have a constitutional doctrine of separation of church and state. And this is traditionally interpreted to say that private citizens can believe whatever they want. You can have whatever religious beliefs you want, and agents of the government can't interfere with that. But also agents of the government can't use their civil authority to punish or promote particular religious ideas.
Right. And for the most part, that works pretty well, except where there's this crossover, where on one side, the science book is saying, there's this thing called evolution. There were these things called dinosaurs.
Yeah.
This is the basic timeline as science understands it versus, more fundamentalist and literal interpretations of biblical tradition.
Right. And this is the most common example in the United States of a conflict between, between the sort of individual beliefs of people who work for the government and the idea that civil servants of the government shouldn't be using their power to inflict their religious beliefs on other people. So a large percent of Americans are what we would call young earth creationists. And what does that mean? Well, a Gallup poll released in June 2014 found that 42% of Americans said they agreed with the following statement, quote, God created human beings pretty much in their present form at one time within the last 10,000 years or so.
Which is, of course, complete nonsense.
Right.
And if you're listening to this podcast, I'm just going to go ahead and assume you do not believe this.
Yeah. As you could guess, this entails a rejection of biological evolution and common descent. Usually, pretty much all of geology, radiometric dating, all mainstream scientific thinking about fossils and paleontology, probably a lot of astronomy and astrophysics too. For example, the creation of the solar system and the formation of galaxies, and probably plenty of other things. You could just generally say that young earth creationism is a belief that encounters generalized difficulty when held alongside a scientific picture of our world.
Yeah, it's that the rejection of the best modern scientific understanding of how the world works and the acceptance of and the reliance upon a sort of modern untangling of ancient Babylonian.
Right. So, but the problem is plenty of civil servants in the United States, especially people who might be teachers in public schools or approving curricula or textbook selection for public schools, hold these beliefs themselves. And they sometimes try to promote these beliefs and their consequences in what are supposed to be secular, religiously neutral classes for all students. And this can take a lot of forms. At one extreme, it might have biology classes teaching about the Garden of Eden and Noah's Ark as an alternative to evolutionary theory. Mm-hmm. At the other end, it might be less overt than that, and it might just insist on biology classes, including materials prepared by creationists that sort of cast vague, unfounded doubts on modern biology, or that teach children scientifically false arguments against evolution, like, you know, things you've heard before, like there are no transitional fossils and stuff like mm-hmm. that. And obviously, this has led to lots of social conflict, big public debates, and lots of court cases. One example of such a court case occurs very close to home for us here in Cobb County, Georgia, which is includes northern suburbs of Atlanta. And on March 28, 2002, the public school officials in Cobb County approved a measure requiring biology textbooks to wear a sticker on the inside cover that has the following statement. It says, evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. And in 2005, this was ruled unconstitutional by U.S. District Judge Clarence Cooper, who said of this ruling, quote, by denigrating evolution, the school board appears to be endorsing the well-known prevailing alternative theory, creationism, or variations thereof, even though the sticker does not specifically reference the alternative theories. And this gets us back to the monster in question, the spaghetti monster. Where did this come from?
Well, this originates with a protest.
Yeah.
A protest against the inclusion of statements like this, stickers like this in science textbooks. Like the basic idea here is, hey, if this nonsense is going to be presented as an alternative to our science, how about this nonsense? How about I just blatantly make something up, just completely off the top of my head, just the craziest thing you can imagine. Let's put that in there as well.
Yeah.
And this, of course, takes us to Kansas.
Yeah, to 2005, when the Kansas State Board of Education had decided to allow intelligent design, the sort of a moniker of creationism. You might call it like a marketing term to make it seem more scientific, like to add a lexicon of scientific vocabulary to creationism. And they said that they wanted to introduce this into the curriculum as an alternative to evolution, you know, teach both theories.
Yeah.
So, then 25-year-old physics graduate Bobby Henderson, wrote what is known as the open letter to the Kansas School Board, published online in 2005, to present his vision for religious inclusivity in the science classroom. Robert, would you like to read a select quote from the letter?
I shall. Quote, I am writing you with much concern after having read of your hearing to decide whether the alternative theory of intelligent design should be taught along with the theory of evolution. Let us remember that there are multiple theories of intelligent design. I and many others around the world are of the strong belief that the universe was created by a flying spaghetti monster.
Right. So throughout this letter, Henderson goes on to critique and satirize the intelligent design arguments by showing how the claims of flying spaghetti monsterism, though they might appear to conflict with scientists around the world, don't actually, because the flying spaghetti monster reaches out with his noodly appendages to tweak the results of experiments so that we will be tricked into believing in an evolutionary model of the old Earth. And he goes on also to insist that when flying spaghetti monsterism is taught in science classrooms, the teacher must wear full pirate regalia. Quote, the concise explanation for this is that he becomes angry if we don't.
Yeah. So, and of course, this leads to wonderful depictions of the flying spaghetti monster.
Yeah.
Which we've all seen before.
Right. The meme very much, it started as a bit of satire, a joke on this religious social movement that, that the author of this letter opposed, but it really took on a life of its own. It became a meme. It became picked up on the internet. So there's artwork, like you said, there's, it's a whole living library of self-referential humor based around this original idea of a flying spaghetti monster, including actually becoming some form of church.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at the evolution of the joke. I mean, I'm often just taken by the visual depictions, because I feel like those really pick up a lot of steam, and the spaghetti monster itself is funny looking. It kind of looks like testicles. So it's inherently goofy.
Yeah. It has meatballs, by the way. It's it's a large pile of spaghetti flying through the sky with eyes and meatballs.
Yeah, generally two. And yeah, to your point, like a lot of, it's kind of a community, assembled, mythos as well. Like everyone, all sorts of little bits and pieces are thrown in kind of willy-nilly to create this overall, faith.
Yeah.
And it's one of those.
The theology is not all top-down.
Right.
It's sort of bottom-up theology.
Yeah. And it's one of those jokes that I think over the years, like when I first heard it, I was kind of like, didn't get the joke. And then I got the joke and I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. But then the joke just keeps going. People
right.
keep telling it to the point, where it's not really that funny anymore.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's kind of like having that, that friend in high school who loves Monty Python so much that
just
they
won't
fit,
stop.
Yeah, they'll just fit a reference or half a skit into every conversation.
Ooh.
Like that's kind of how I feel about Pastafari.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. And also, I would say that in some cases, it evolved from a specific satire of teaching of young earth creationism in public schools to become a more general critique of religion across the board, which I think is not necessarily what the author originally intended.
Right. But yeah, it definitely becomes kind of a, you know, an atheistic protest religion.
Yeah.
And it serves a useful purpose there, I think. You know, it continually argues, hey, why do we believe in the things we believe in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is this valuable and this isn't? And, you know, as a joke goes, it has proven to be effective, you know, in the way that jokes can often tear down the most formidable walls in our society, but also, you know, piss people off royally.
Now, I can take the other side for a second and say that I can understand why some religious people would be less than impressed with this joke as it exists today, because let's be fair, in a lot of cases, it does seem to represent a just sort of generalized critique, and critique might be a generous word, of religion without much attempt to understand people's religions or doctrines and the values they provide to the people that, that hold them.
Yeah, it is.
You can just look at it as a kind of shallow, outsider mockery.
Yeah. And I definitely, you know, I can definitely relate to some of those feelings about it, you know, over the years, because at times I have felt like, not only is it a joke that I maybe don't get or I don't find as funny, but yeah, I could also see where it's a little offensive, you know, because it's kind of like you're taking just 3 minutes to throw up a spaghetti monster image to rebuke a person's lifetime of faith, you know, to rebuke their cultural heritage in many cases.
Right. But as we said, this is becoming a new heritage of its own.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see what the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster looks like in 20 years.
Yeah, I think for the most part, for most people, it's remains that bumper sticker level of involvement. You know, it is just something you throw up on social media or stick on the back of your car. Other people have taken it to greater extremes, going in and trying to get their official, you know, state ID with a colander on their head, which is, of course, one of the other articles of faith.
Right.
For the adherence.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And other folks have pushed for official religious status, which is really taking it to the next level, saying not only is our joke religion jokey, but it is actually a religion, or it is as real a religion as your religion, and we want the government to recognize that fact.
And I think there are some governments that have recognized it, right?
Yeah, at least the Netherlands and New Zealand to some degree. The Netherlands was where we saw the most recent headlines about it. And apparently they had to prove that it wasn't just a fad, that it was an actual thing that people believed in, and that they had like a marriage ritual, that sort of thing. So that it's the kind of thing that people are invested in enough that it is, you know, potentially a part of your life.
Yeah, and this leads us to the realization that a religion need not be ancient in order to be followed.
Oh, yeah.
So I stand by what I said earlier about a lot of the aesthetic power of religion does seem to come from its antiquity and its chronological alienation, the sort of alien holiness of the distant past. But this doesn't mean you can't create religions in the modern day that gain a following.
Yeah, I mean, we've already mentioned Rastafari, which is an Abrahamic religion. You know, certainly with a lot of elements that are based in deep history, but it also venerated, emperor of Ethiopia, Haile Selassie.
Yeah.
You know, and it's certainly a religion I would love to look at in greater depth, at some point in the future. But yeah, you have a situation where it's in the past, it's taking place in the present. And I mean, to have your Messiah live and die within the lifespan of the faith, and to see that sort of happen in recent history,
yeah,
it's fascinating.
Well, how about Joseph Smith and the Latter-day Saints?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's another good one. Its origins date back to around 1830. This is a millennialist religion that preached the impending second coming, continuing revelations, and an identity and values that I guess you could say were more grounded in the temporary setting. So,
yeah,
you know, it's America. It's there's a modern cosmology.
It's a very American religion.
Yeah, very much so.
If you don't realize, this is the official name of the Mormons.
Yes.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
And it, too, of course, sprang up around a single charismatic individual. And it's actually a very interesting religion to look at in terms of science as well. Since it is more closely tied to our scientific age, you do find elements of it that are that conflict less with modern scientific cosmology, such as the idea that there are other planets and that there is a potential for life on other worlds.
Oh, yeah. Though even without the introduction of new holy texts, such as the Book of Mormon,
mm-hmm.
you could point out that lots of modern Christians have adapted their beliefs to include modern science.
Oh, certainly.
I mean, when we looked at the numbers from 2014, from that Gallup poll, only 42% of Americans adhered to a literal understanding of the Bible. And so that's obviously not even, maybe that's like half of Christians or something in America.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can certainly still be a Christian, according to me anyway. I mean, this is going to vary depending on who's serving you your Christianity. But yeah, you can still be a Christian and not believe that there was a literal Garden of Eden. You can still look at something like Noah's Ark and view it as mythology.
Yeah.
Without view it as mythology, not in the as a dismissal, but understanding the power of myth and the necessity of myth in our culture.
Right. Well, or you might not even put it in those terms. You might just say like, well, you know, it's a story that's part of our received tradition and I accept it as a story, but also I wouldn't deny what the evidence in the lab says. I mean, that would be foolish. So one is science and one is my religion. And, you know, you don't have to smash them together in a particle collider of my brain.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at it as literature. You can look at it as mythology. If you want, you can look at it as some sort of a literal historical document, but to do so is to throw out our modern understanding of the world.
Yeah. So how about the other recently created religion that we opened with, talking about Scientology? Like we said, the Barbet story probably isn't true, but Scientology certainly is a religion explicitly created in the 20th century.
That's right, 1954. Contemporary, individual-focused movement, elements of science fiction, New Age philosophy, and psychoanalysis, though it also has historically been anti-psychiatry.
Right.
And
I think it sort of almost positions itself as an alternative to psychiatry.
Yes, yeah, I think very much so. And one of them, we're not going to go in deep into all the mysteries of Scientology here, but it essentially says that we're all alien souls called thetans that bounce around from life to life. One attempts to free oneself from this cycle and attain their true self. So it's kind of like space Buddhism.
Yeah.
Which, you know, without getting into any other details, I could get behind the idea of some space Buddhism. I could see the appeal.
In the abstract, at least. Though, as you note, it is a pretty divisive religion. Everybody's got an opinion on it.
Yeah, it's hard to find. And I'm one of those people that I would love to see more just like objective down the middle coverage of Scientology, but for the most part, it's either, certainly just researching online, you're going to find one voice or the other in very drastically different positions on the matter. Now, any of the religions that we've mentioned so far, you can definitely go at them and point out at least little bits and pieces that don't match up with our scientific understanding of reality. You can say, hey, bees didn't have four legs, as we've mentioned in a previous episode.
Sure.
There were no New World horses prior to the colonial presence in North America.
Hold on. How is that relevant?
Some criticize the Book of Mormon and point to passages about horses and use this as a sort of a rallying point for, oh, you're totally full of it because this thing doesn't match up with real life.
Okay.
Likewise, you can say, oh, there are no demonic space aliens. There was no Xenu, etc. But as we're about to discuss, there are religions or hyper-religions, as they're sometimes called, in which there is definite fiction going on. Like the whole bedrock for the faith is fiction.
Everybody agrees that it's fiction.
Yeah, nobody's
even
saying,
the people on the inside.
Yeah, so it's not a situation where someone is having to say, well, you know, this one little detail about horses or bees or what have you, it doesn't match up because X, Y, and Z. They're saying, oh no, I fully agree with you. This is all fiction. But the thing that comes out of that fiction is real.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient. I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But We Loved is a new podcast about queer history coming May 15th. I'm Jordan Gonsalves, your host. Growing up, I thought being gay was the worst thing I could ever be. The gay history I learned was tragic.
Jerry had died of AIDS, and it's like, what is happening?
It was survival. That's why it's called survival sex.
But as I interviewed queer elders, I realized there was another history that I had never been taught. A history of courage and perseverance.
I wanted to take control of my story and not be ashamed of it.
And it was a history full of love.
The joy we found in saying husband again and again and again was incredible.
And while learning this new queer history from my elders, I realized they had so much wisdom to pass down.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
From iHeart Podcasts, I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and this is But We Loved. Listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right. We're talking about religions that draw inspiration from fictional narratives that don't claim to adhere to reality at all. And, right. And here we're going to get into a little bit of the work of a sort of cultural critic and sociologist named Adam Possamai. And Possamai's got a, he's got a book that came out in 2005 called Religion and Popular Culture, A Hyper-Real Testament. I like that title.
Yeah.
And in this book, he builds on some postmodern social theory. Now, don't worry, we're not going to get too into the weeds of social theory and postmodern criticism. But basically, here's how it goes. It says the 20th century represents a turn from traditional cultural structures to individualized consumer experiences driven by capitalism. So just think about that for a second. And he says, of course, this extends to religion. And so if you think about that, it's sort of saying that instead of having a structure like a community accountable to one another that gathers to pray and worship in the received antique tradition, people consume their religion individually in the same way they do their shopping and their media experiences. Religion becomes a commodified, consumerized thing that you can pick off the shelf and take home with you. And I'm not sure I totally agree, but I think there is at least a grain of truth to this. Simply by looking at the aesthetics of religion in America today, you could point to, for example, I think the rise of televangelism, TV ministry networks.
You can change the channel if you don't agree.
At-home religious participation on your own time with a TV program. Mm-hmm. You could also look at mega churches, which I think are a really interesting cultural phenomenon. They have huge congregations. And what's the point of the huge congregation? Well, if you wanted to look at it from this critical point of view, you could say really a huge congregation like that provides each individual churchgoer a kind of Walmart level of anonymity. Yeah. You don't have to have a personal relationship. You just go and sort of consume as another face in the crowd, as a on your own time, on your own terms.
Yeah. Now, of course, that also can be the very thing about a megachurch that would turn someone away is that they want to go into a church. They want to be recognized.
Right.
They want to be an individual. They want to be part of a community.
Yeah, exactly. But then also you could look at their attention grabbing multimedia experiences like, you know, let's watch Pastor Trent rock out with the praise band on the Jumbotron. Mm-hmm. Which there's certainly plenty of that. And sometimes they've even got truly built-in shopping experiences. You've got coffee shops, bookstores in the church and stuff like that. And so this is the work that I think Possumai is building on. And so Possumai, when he gets to the concept of hyper-real religion, he makes a comparison between trends in fantasy literature mm-hmm. and trends in religion. And so he starts out by looking at fantasy fiction, and he says essentially that fantasy fiction has this traditional library of tropes, styles, and contents from which it usually draws, like sword and sorcery fiction. Possumai claims that this is based mostly on chivalric or medieval romance, like the Arthurian cycle, you know, King Arthur and those kind of stories. They form the library of things which the modern fantasy author can now reach in and grab and put together in his or her own way. And so among the standard library of tropes are things like magic, creatures, thieves, warriors, druids, wizards, orcs, elves.
Yeah.
What else?
Oh,
gelatinous cubes.
Yeah. All the standard Dungeons and Dragons, characters, creatures, and tropes for sure.
But then Possumai points to an interesting development in the history of fantasy, which he singles out as the 2002 video game Kingdom Hearts. Now, I've never played this. Have you?
No, but I'm familiar with the series, especially its crossovers with like Disney material. But yeah, I did not expect Kingdom Hearts to show up in the material here.
But this is exactly what he points out. I think it's a really interesting point. He says, okay, Kingdom Hearts is a video game following a very traditional fantasy plot in some ways. Mm-hmm. It has a traditional fantasy plot structure. There's a quest. There's a main character who has a sort of symbolic sword, and the main character is seeking reunification with friends who are lost. It all sounds like this could be Tolkien or something. But instead of having all of just the regular Dungeons and Dragons chivalry, you know, the knights and the elves and the orcs and all that, it's got characters from Disney movies, like you say. So it's got characters from Aladdin and Peter Pan and mm-hmm. 101 Dalmatians and Alice in Wonderland. And so he's looking at this as saying, huh, so when you put yourself in the fantasy mindset, mm-hmm. you kind of have to accept as real all of the tropes that are being pulled from the antique library of medieval and fantasy tropes like wizards and stuff like that. That's the real material that you work with within the fantasy realm. But this is bringing in all this stuff where people are explicitly familiar with the origins. Uh-huh. Disney movies they saw when they were a kid, and now they're part of the fantasy library.
Huh. Yeah, this just makes me think about walking around the office here at How Stuff Works. You go by each desk and everyone has at least, it seems like one figurine, right? One action figure, some sort of a pop culture comic booky character that is serving as kind of an avatar, kind of an icon, kind of a holy artifact.
A little god, a little shrine at your desk.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like I think about in my own situation, like I carry a Ganesha in my pocket. Ganesha being, of course, the Hindu little elephant deity, the remover of obstacles. And so, you know, I carry him around as a kind of a good luck token. Uh-huh. But on my desk here at work, I also have a Gamera and a Tom Servo. which
very fine idols.
Yeah, and they kind of embody certain, you know, maybe not completely thought out ideas, but they embody certain nostalgic powers and thematic powers that I kind of draw on as I work.
Gamera has stuff we can all get behind. He loves all children.
It's right. He's a friend of children, and he breathes fire and flies. So he's a powerful force to turn to.
So anytime there's a bat in your vicinity that begins to emit rays, you know that you have Gamera on your side.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, to what extent are all these little creatures and little toy? I mean, they are all kind of religious icons. They're kind of the gods of the new age, right?
Yeah. And so we should note about, Possumi before we continue that in the academic community, postmodern religious and cultural criticism, there's been, you know, a ton of ink spilled debating the merits of Possumi's definitions and analysis. We're not going to get into all that. We're not going to get into these debates. We can just focus on the example itself, basically.
Yeah, I mean, all of it is subjective analysis. So
right.
There's nothing definite about any of it.
Yeah.
But it does make a lot of sense, and that's why we're discussing it here.
But essentially the idea is creating religions inspired by source material that the religion's own adherents accept to be fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's run through some examples of this, because I know if you're not familiar with this, your brain's probably going in circles here. Like, how do you base a religion? It's one thing to say, oh, I get some inspiration from a Gamera, but how would you actually have a Gamera-based faith?
Well, do you mind if I talk about the Jedi first?
Talk about the Jedi. Yeah.
Okay, so how about Jediism? Have you folks heard of this? Jediism? Jedism or Jediism?
Jedism always makes me think of Jed from Beverly Hillbillies. So.
It's the religion of Jed Clampett, yes, because he came across the black gold, so he must be inspired.
Yes, the god led him there.
But anyway, Jediism is a Star Wars-inspired religion that takes after the Jedi Knights of the Star Wars universe, who were the heroes. I mean, I probably don't need to explain the Star Wars context to you. I assume you've seen it. If not, suffice to say, they're, you know, a quasi-mystical religious order of good guys facing off against an evil empire.
Well, evil in quotation marks. I don't know how evil they actually were, but.
Oh, so you've got a bone to pick there.
Well, it's not really worth picking at this point. But.
Never mind. Okay, so anyway, in my best judgment, Jedi pretty clearly began as a joke. Just explicitly a joke.
Mm-hmm.
First example, the 2001 census phenomenon. So around the time of the year 2001, there was a widespread international email campaign urging people to list Jedi as their religion on official census forms. And it worked. It worked. According to the BBC, in the 2001 UK census, 390,127 people, which amounted to about 0.7% of the population at the time, listed their religion as some variation on Jedi on that census, Jedi or Jedi Knight, something like that.
Okay.
Same year, according to the Sydney Morning Herald, 70,509 Australians, or about 0.37% of Australians, registered as Jedi on the 2001 census. So at the time, I think everybody assumed this was sort of like flying spaghetti monsterism. It's a joke carried out by atheists and secularists, maybe trying to point out something about the arbitrariness of people's religious beliefs. Maybe they thought they were making a point. Maybe they didn't even think they were making a point. Maybe they just thought it was funny to say I'm a Jedi,
yeah,
instead of to say no religion or none or something.
Yeah, and it's probably the kind of thing where in many of these cases, not a tremendous amount of thought is not going into this. It's just kind of a gut reaction, but the roots may run a little deeper than they're conscious of.
Yeah, so that was 2001, but if you look at the website now of the Temple of the Jedi Order, and if you listen to their spokespeople, it starts to seem less and less like a joke. Or even a statement in order to make a point. If you look at them now, the Jedi have beliefs. They have doctrines. They have creedal statements. And it sounds to me perhaps unsettlingly sincere. I don't mean unsettling as in I'm mocking them. I just mean it's surprising.
Yeah.
So I want to read a couple little things from the Temple of the Jedi Order. These are statements they have. One is the Jedi Code, and there are two versions of it. I want to read the simplified version. The Jedi Code reads, emotion, yet peace. Ignorance, yet knowledge. Passion, yet serenity. chaos, yet harmony, death, yet the force.
Okay, that sounds pleasingly mystic and deep, yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's also a Jedi creed, believe it or not. So this is their creed. I am a Jedi, an instrument of peace. Where there is hatred, I shall bring love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. I am a Jedi. I shall never seek so much to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we're pardoned, and it is in dying that we're born to eternal life. The Force is with me always, for I am a Jedi.
Okay, so this makes me instantly wonder, are we witnessing here the evolution of a faith or the evolution of the joke? Are we kind of in like the Andy Kaufman period of the joke where we're just forced to feel kind of confused and maybe a little uncomfortable about where we stand in bit versus reality?
I don't know, because so first of all, that creed I read there, they said they claim that is actually adapted from a traditional prayer of St. Francis of Assisi.
Ah, okay.
So that's sort of interesting that they're adapting traditional religious materials. But I also listened to an interview with a spokesperson from the organization, the Temple of the Jedi. And you know what? He seemed to me like a level-headed guy who was not playing a prank. In fact, the weirdest thing was he didn't even seem like all that obsessive of a Star Wars fan.
Yeah.
and he explained that all the Jedi believe in the Force, but the Jedi need not believe in like a literal physical reality of the Force as an energy field that surrounds us and binds us, though apparently you can believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, he made it sound like the Force can be defined however you like. It can be a physical reality, it can be a metaphor for the interconnectedness of the universe, or it can be something else entirely, pretty much whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed very earnest and serious about Jediism being taken seriously as a religion, or if not a religion, as a sort of philosophy accorded the same cultural respect as a religion.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because what is Star Wars but sort of a rehashing and reassemblage of various mythic tropes, right?
Yeah, and he pointed to exactly this thing. He said Star Wars doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know,
it
draws on traditional philosophies and religions, and so we're essentially using Star Wars as a metaphorical way to go back to these ancient traditions.
So it's kind of like, hey, I really love Star Wars. Why do I love Star Wars? And then if the answer is, well, some of these belief systems are kind of appealing to me, if you then explore the roots of those things and begin to find meaning in the roots of those things without abandoning that initial science fiction lens, like continuing to have that be a part of your, I'm hesitant to say worldview, but let's say your spiritual construction, then you have yourself a hyper-real religion.
Yeah. But the Star Wars universe is not the only one that has created movements like this. I think there are others that I would say chart a similar path. It looks to me, and like I have to admit, as with all these, I'm an outsider, so I can't speak as a Jedi or something, and I don't want to diminish people's experiences in that faith or in any other faith. But what I'll say is it looks to me like it definitely started as a joke.
Well,
and it took on a seriousness, and there are others like that. Like,
well, that's just like your opinion, man.
Right? How about the dude?
That's right. Dudism is another big one.
I assume we also have some Big Lebowski fans.
Hope so. Yeah, the Big Lebowski, the Coen brothers, just wonderful film. It didn't really do well when it came out, but it's one of those that has continued to just gain a cult following, conventions, and even its own hyperreal religion in the form of dudism. So it's basically all boils down to the dude abides, right?
Yeah.
It's a dude-centric philosophy and lifestyle, more or less a modern pop culture take on Taoism.
Taoism, I've heard it described also as having a lot of similarities to Zen Buddhism.
Yeah, indeed. It's chill. It's peaceful. It's all of the positive aspects of the dude. without some of his more, you know, reckless or laziness.
Well, you know, one of the funny things is that the thing about the dude is that he's chill, but throughout much of the movie, the dude is not chill.
Yeah, the dude gets a little irritated and is even criticized by the stranger for his vulgar language. So it's one of the, this is another great example though, where you, when you look at dudism, you see the people who follow it or at least like to talk about it, it all does begin in that kind of bumper sticker area. Like, it's fun to say, hey, what's your religion? Oh, it's dudism, you know, because I really love this movie. But you see the same thing, right? You see individuals who seem to follow the roots of it or sort of ask themselves questions. Well, if dudism were a real faith, if it were a real philosophy, what would its tenets be? What would I need to understand? And then they sort of follow it backwards into, you know, more historical modes of belief.
Yeah. And I think this would encounter the same kind of, criticisms from outsiders that all these others would. People would be like, wait a second, hold on. What do you mean? Do you really believe in dudism? Is that really your religion?
Well, it kind of makes me think of, you remember Winamp?
Oh yeah.
The old MP3 player that we all had on our computer.
Did you have some good skins?
That's the thing. You had different skins, right? We all had the same program, but we used different skins that appeal to us personally.
Did you have like a Tool skin on Winamp?
Oh, I think I had some sort of like horrible blood splattery one or something like that. It was nice and dark and moody, but I can't help but feel like we encounter something similar with these hyper real religions that we're discussing, where the actual mode of belief, the actual mechanics are either something old or something cobbled together from other beliefs, but it's that skin that brings us in. That skin is unique and appeals to us.
I got another one. I was trying to tell Rachel last night mm-hmm. about Jediism.
Yeah.
My wife Rachel, about Jediism.
To convert her or to Jediism?
Right.
Or just to,
no. Just to explain it. And, okay. And she was like, oh, I bet there is this for Lord of the Rings. And what do you know? There are Tolkien inspired religious ideas, which is very interesting to me, because I would say that in some ways Tolkien is sort of adapting Christianity to a fantasy setting.
Yeah.
Or at least some ideas of Christianity. It's not like an explicit one-to-one metaphor, but a lot of his messages, I think, in Lord of the Rings are Christian ones.
Yeah, it's these sort of vague Tolkien-esque neo-pagan religions. They're interesting because, yeah, the book itself, There are often these arguments, you know, people saying, oh, this is a pagan work and the pagan elements are what's important here. Others saying, no, it's inherently a Christian work. Other people saying, oh, it's a synthesis of the two. And maybe all of these arguments are ultimately kind of silly, but it's a very popular work, and especially out of the 1970s, where you saw people were really into Tolkien. There's still a lot of counter-cultural energy going on.
It's in Led Zeppelin albums.
Yeah, it's
Come
in
on.
Led Zeppelin albums, and it has a lot of power to it. It has a lot of depth to it. You can just go completely crazy, filling in all the details in your mind about the world of Tolkien.
We maybe don't advise that.
No, well, you go for it if you want. That's one thing I always enjoy about the various sci-fi and fantasy properties that really engage me, is if there's a really rich mythos there, either one that is explicitly laid out for you, or one where there are all these holes that you can't help but fill in the details yourself.
You know, we were talking about this concept of hyper-real religions, and Christian Sager, our other host, brought Satanism to mind.
That's right. And if anyone remembers the Satanic Panic episode that Christian and I did, I guess about a year ago now, as we discussed in that, Satanism like never really existed. Certainly not in the way that that it was presented during the Satanic Panic.
Right. I mean, I would say that what you have as Satanism, people who would actually claim this religion, is almost explicitly an atheistic religion.
Right. Yeah. And generally when we talk about Satanism, we're talking about Levian Satanism, which was comes from the Church of Satan, founded in 1966 by Anton LaVey. It was, you know, ultimately it's an atheistic individualist philosophy. It's with more than a dash of drama, symbolism, fun. It's about messing with the squares and putting on a fun show.
Well, in some ways, I think it has a lot in common with the Flying Spaghetti Monster-ism, in that mm-hmm. it's maybe more than this, but in some ways you could think of it as a massive prank.
Yes, very much so. And I think LaVey, I think, was pretty straightforward about that. I mean, this is a guy that came from sort of carny roots. It's a very carny faith. And I love it. You can't help but get involved with the trappings of it, especially, as the years roll by and it becomes a part of an entire segment of music, right? You get into all this death metal that has varying degrees of satanic elements.
All right, but I think it's time to turn to psychology to try to see what we can figure out about what people are actually trying to get out of these religious beliefs. It seems fairly clear what people get out of traditional religious beliefs, where there is at the core of them the assumption of a real revelation about the metaphysical nature of reality. Maybe not in all of them, but in lots of them. But in these religious beliefs that are in some way based on what everybody agrees is fiction, what is the goal of the seeker, of the adherent?
Well, one take on this comes from Carol M. Cusack's Invented Religions, Imagination, Fiction, and Faith. And she posits that invented religions, such as the ones we're discussing here, they demonstrate that what meaning-hungry humans really want is a powerful narrative, particularly one in which unseen agents affect causality in our world and in our lives.
Okay, so maybe saying that even if we don't agree that the narratives refer to a thing that's literally true, just participation in the narrative is enough.
Yeah, I mean, like the fictional realm becomes the place where it is okay to dream, whereas to dream in the more real world of religious history, that is sometimes seen as a bit weird in some circles.
Well, that relates to something that I know we read a little bit about why fantasy is popular these days.
It actually reminds me of some thoughts, some observations that R. Scott Baker made. R. Scott Baker himself being a successful and, in my opinion, highly talented fantasy writer himself, background in philosophy, and also he works a fair amount of neuroscience into his creations. But in his paper that published on Science Fiction and Fantasy World, Why Fantasy and Why Now, he says that fantasy is, quote, the primary literary response to what is often called the contemporary crisis of meaning. So the idea here is that we live in an age of reason and science. We have all sorts of myth-erasing answers for how the world works, so long as we don't require teleological answers. So this gets down to, you know, we have all these answers about how, say, the solar system works, how life works.
Yeah.
But we don't have the whys, right? That's the stuff that is beyond science.
Yeah. He almost says science is essentially created too reliable of a tool for finding correct answers about reality, and so reliable, in fact, that it has left us with nihilism.
Yeah.
Now we don't necessarily need to agree with that perspective to say that certainly a lot of people probably feel this way, that if science is the only socially legitimate way of asserting that something is definitely true, where do you get your meaning of life from?
Yeah.
If science is not going to give that to you. And it can lead to a sense of kind of despair, of hopelessness, of emptiness. You know, what is life really all about? I mean, who cares if I can finally understand the mysteries of quantum physics if what it reveals is that, there's no way to answer the question of the meaning of life.
Yeah. So you end up turning to fantasy, and to a certain extent, science fiction, but largely we're talking about fantasy. You turn to these fantastic stories in which you can find, if not find that meaning for yourself, then you at least embody characters who find that meaning and live in a world where life and then the individual has significance.
Now, I personally probably wouldn't agree with Baker that this is what is entailed by the scientific view of the world. But I can certainly see how if you do go to that conclusion, fantasy could provide a very powerful escape from it.
Right. And, you know, I do have to say R. Scott Baker's own work, his Second Apocalypse series, he grounds these – it's definitely dark fantasy, but he grounds these many of these characters in this very believable philosophical place that is at times like you lose yourself in the story, in the narrative, in the world, but other times he forces the reader to really ask some troubling questions about who we are and how we work as individuals.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would say that his critique of fantasy genre does not apply to everything within that realm, and it certainly doesn't apply to all readers.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters.
It's an election year, so there's a lot of focus on the voters that TikTok is reaching.
The initial reaction is like, oh, things are looking so resilient.
I don't want to be too pessimistic, but I just don't see the political will down in Washington right now to change their tune.
I think the American electorate has been signaling that it expects a rematch of the 2020 election. These are unprecedented times.
With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is right around the corner, and in true She Pivots fashion, we're highlighting moms who've dedicated their lives and their pivots to supporting mothers. The iconic Christy Turlington will join us to talk about launching Every Mother Counts after pivoting from her 90s supermodel days. And later, the co-CEOs of Baby to Baby will share how they're addressing the needs for millions of babies and moms. So tune in and subscribe to She Pivots. New episodes out every Wednesday. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But We Loved is a new podcast about queer history coming May 15th. I'm Jordan Gonsalves, your host. Growing up, I thought being gay was the worst thing I could ever be. The gay history I learned was tragic.
Jerry had died of AIDS, and it's like, what is happening?
It was survival. That's why it's called survival sex.
But as I interviewed queer elders, I realized there was another history that I had never been taught. A history of courage and perseverance.
I wanted to take control of my story and not be ashamed of it.
And it was a history full of love.
The joy we found in saying husband again and again and again was incredible.
And while learning this new queer history from my elders, I realized they had so much wisdom to pass down.
The key is to understanding yourself, learning to love and embrace yourself.
From iHeart Podcasts, I'm Jordan Gonsalves, and this is But We Loved. Listen to But We Loved May 15th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It does, comes back to the question, right? What do modern religious individuals want?
He would say maybe meaning, right?
Right. He would say meaning. He would tie it into this idea. He coined the term the semantic apocalypse. This idea that we are either at the point or we're approaching this point where we're just completely stupefied by the lack of meaning in our lives and in the world.
But then again, I mean, I'm sure there have been some scientific studies that look into what it is that people want out of religions in general.
There have, yeah. And one in particular, and again, this is when we're talking about papers and studies about religion, this is all ultimately, you know, subjective analysis. So feel free to disagree and argue with us. And but in this case, according to Ohio State University professor Stephen Rice, author of the 2016 book, The 16 Strivings for God, he says people have 16 basic desires.
I liked these.
I like these
too.
This
was interesting.
Yeah. Acceptance, curiosity, eating, family, honor, idealism, independence, order, physical activity, power, romance, saving, social contact, status, tranquility, and vengeance.
And that's a pretty good list. I was trying to think of things other than that.
Yeah, though, I think he covered all the basics there. And you can't help but look at that list and sort of check things off in your head as you look at your own, either your own religious beliefs, your spiritualism, or the fantasy that you're into.
Yeah.
But he developed this Rice motivation profile that measures how much people value each of these 16 goals. And he administered it to, 100,000 plus people.
Wow.
And he found that the appeal of any given religion relates to how it responds to one or more of those desires. And it competes with secular society to meet those desires. So think about it. In what ways can both traditional religions and hyper-real religions meet many of these desires, such as, stuff like curiosity? I can definitely see the appeal of that because one of the things that always drew me into actual religions and continues to draw me into actual religions is the mystery and the creativity, the interplay and narratives of these gods and heroes, right?
Yeah.
It's what brings me into, reading of Hinduism. It brings me into reading, about ancient Egypt. It brings me into reading, various fantasy novels as well.
Well, I mean, in some cases, I think this might grow out of a slight disconnect between the things we need, you know, these things we strive for and desire versus what we really know is appropriate in modern society, given that we've started to think out ethical issues in a secular way. I don't know if you can say that there's really a good, widely agreed upon secular justification for things like a desire for honor.
Yeah.
And yet the ancient structures of fantasy or of traditional religions or something like that might all include concepts of honor that can sort of legitimate this desire that we have biologically, even if we can't think of a good reason to seek honor.
Yeah, it makes more something like honor often makes more sense in a simplified and highly symbolic world than it does in the minutiae of real life.
Yeah.
Likewise, something like vengeance, which made the list. Like, vengeance is something that in your own life, like, vengeance is kind of icky.
It's a thing we all desire, but most of us would probably agree we sort of know better than to try to get it.
Right. But like a religious faith, you have some sort of hell doctrine in there. You have the wrath of God.
You can outsource vengeance.
Yeah.
You can say, I don't have to get revenge. Something bad might happen to you outside of my control.
Yeah. And likewise, we continually turn to fictional models of what vengeance might consist of. I mean, revenge tales have always been popular and will continue to be popular. And again, they often fall back on a simplified and highly symbolic world.
You know, I wonder if studies on religious experience would indicate that hyper-reality could become or is becoming the new norm for religious experiences.
Yeah, it often reminds me of the line in Big Trouble in Little China from the sorcerer Egg Shen, who talks about Chinese modes of belief and saying that it's like a salad bar that you choose. You take what you like and you leave the rest. In this case, the character was referring to Confucianism and Taoism and also Buddhism as well.
Uh-huh.
But I find that increasingly in my own life that I do that, that I kind of take what I want from these various models, including some fictional models, and incorporate it into my sort of religious spiritual worldview. There's actually a 2015 study from the University of Evansville published in American Sociological Review, and it took a pretty thorough look at the way Americans process religion and science. So the authors crunched data from three waves of the General Social Survey and found that U.S. adults hold one of three perspectives based on their knowledge and attitudes about science and religion. Now, the first two are long established, but the third is, according to the authors, entirely new.
Uh-huh.
So there's a modern perspective, a worldview that favors science over religion, and that scored 36%.
Okay. Right.
Science trumps religion. That's that version. Then there's a traditional perspective, a worldview that favors religion over science. 43%, which, to interpret that score as you will. But then the third one is the post-secular perspective, a worldview that values both science and religion, but, quote, rejects science in favor of religion when it comes to topics such as creation and evolution. And that scored 21%. So that is kind of the salad bar situation in action there, right?
Okay.
Where the individual is willing to favor science and religion. In fact, favor science over religion, except for those places where it becomes teleologically difficult, where if not overt issues of meaning come into play, then at least implied meaning, you know, implied issues of meaning. So, you know, it's like ultimately, I think there can be a strong case to be made that what does it matter if life evolved or if the hand of God shaped it? But if your interpretation sees one version as problematic or threatening to the overall religious structure in your head, then in this case, you're going to favor that religious construct over the science.
Yeah. And a separate question, I think, would be just what are the triggers that cause people to view these things as in conflict anyway? Like, some people obviously hold both views in their heads without trouble, and some people perceive a conflict.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what makes the difference, but it seems significant.
Yeah. So what we're talking about here, the post-secular perspective, it's not a mere midpoint between the traditional and the modern, but rather a unique way of looking at reality through the combined lenses of science and religion. So you can think of it as kind of a hybrid view. And I think that the hyper-real religions that we're looking at are kind of represent a hybrid view of a slightly different form.
Uh-huh.
Where instead of rejecting the science that threatens meaning, we're going to outsource the religion into a sort of a safe bucket, into the bucket of fiction, and then build from there.
I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. Like we said, I mean, a lot of these people who have these beliefs, I get the sense, are basically basically materialist humanists.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they typically have humanist values. They could subscribe to the Humanist Manifesto, and they typically don't believe in spirits or something,
right?
Anything other than the natural world. That certainly isn't the case for all of them, but that seems to be a dominant way of thinking. But like as we know from Buddhism and stuff like that, you need not be a supernaturalist in order to be a religious person.
Right, yeah, and there are ways of engaging. I mean, just for Buddhism on its own, you can take a very sort of abstract philosophical approach to Buddhism, where you don't literally believe in life-to-life reincarnation.
Right.
Or you can take one that is very traditional, and ultimately, you know, it's all about being fearful and responding from a place of fear in terms of what your next incarnation will consist of.
I had another idea based in psychology about what might explain some of this. I mean, I certainly mm-hmm. wouldn't want to say that all of it could is explained by this, but it could explain some of the transition from joke religions into real religions. And it would be based in the idea of sunk costs, choice supportive bias, and post-purchase rationalization.
Ah, okay.
So let's say you spend a lot of money on a new lawnmower.
Okay, and I can't imagine it happening in my case, but
you've mowed the lawn a few times, and you start to worry that maybe you didn't spend your money all that well.
Mm-hmm.
So you start to engage in an internal conversation, which is a form of choice supportive bias, a bias towards validating the choice you already made. That's called post-purchase rationalization. You start coming up with reasons why, you know, this really was a good way to spend my money. I think I did the right thing by spending the money on this lawnmower, because it could sort of lead to some unpleasant cognitive dissonance if you don't come to that conclusion. You could think, man, I really screwed up. I shouldn't have gone down this road.
So it's kind of gets into the area, if I read Dune three times, or more times than that even, maybe it wasn't just a good book. Maybe it wasn't just a great book, but maybe it was a book that was so meaningful that it achieves kind of a spiritual level.
Exactly. Or in another way, it could be true that, let's say, if you spent a lot of time and effort just carrying out a joke, mm-hmm. just on a prank religion, let's say you start spending time on dudism because you love The Big Lebowski and because it's funny. It's funny to pretend that there's a dude religion. But after realizing how much sunk cost you've incurred in your own time and energy over a long period of time, you start seeking ways to rationalize the purchase of these beliefs by saying, maybe if I've spent 300 hours on dudism, was it really just a joke? Maybe it wasn't just a joke. Maybe there's really some meaning in this. And that's not even to say that the meaning you find is invalid, if that's your method of coming to that meaning. I would say that, conclusions reached through choice supportive bias aren't necessarily untrue conclusions.
I think in many cases, the time and financial investment involved here, it just forces you to double down on something that you were already inclined to support or inclined to buy into, you know? It's like, I already thought this was a great idea, but, now that I've potentially wasted this much time on it, it's definitely a great idea.
One other thing I wanted to note, I was interested to see what you thought of this, is that these religions, the hyper-real religions, especially like Jediism and Dudeism, seem to be very much creatures of the internet. In fact, even I mentioned that I listened to an interview with a spokesperson of the Jedi Temple. The guy who I listened to explicitly pointed to the introduction of internet fan communities and forums in the 1990s as the thing that made the Jedi religion possible. And so that makes me wonder how the internet has changed what's possible in terms of social movements and the birth of religions.
Well, yeah, I mean, the internet has made it possible to find those communities of people that share your belief. You might be the only person in your small town that loves Star Wars as much as you do, but the internet allows you to find all those other individuals who are as invested. And you find the community, in your fandom that one could, you know, that would one could previously find perhaps only in something like a religion. You're finding that religious community in your fandom.
But then again, I come back to the question. I mean, I have to wonder what the evolution of this looks like over a long time. Could you ever reach the point where there are Jediists who believe in the truth of Jediism so firmly that they would actually come to the position of the creationists we talked about at the beginning, where they would want their views taught as an alternative to modern science in schools, where they would say, you know, I don't just say that this is a useful framework for my life that kind of makes sense to me. I say this is how reality is, and I've got the exclusive truth.
Huh.
I mean, it's hard to imagine with the Jediists of today who, like we said, seem to be just sort of like taking from the salad bar of interesting ideas, but who knows what would be possible in the future.
Yeah, well, it seems to me it would be less of a conflict between science and this kind of storytelling mythology, but it would be more of a conflict between mythology. So it would be more in line with a Jediist saying, hey, if you're going to teach the children about Greek mythology, and if you're going to teach them about, you know, about Hinduism or some of these other, modes of sort of mythological belief, then you have to teach them about our mode as well.
Because, about Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, because our mode has all of those old ideas, but it's been kind of purified, through the lens of modern culture.
Well, I will say, I do believe Obi-Wan Kenobi is much wiser than most of the Greek gods.
he's a very wise, individual. It's hard not to. Oh, I don't know. Some of his choices in the prequels may have been a little bit boneheaded.
I'm not even talking about that.
That's okay, heretical. Okay, heretical. Right. Okay.
Yes. Blasphemy. Robert, what's your own personal choice for hyperreal religion?
If
you had to go with one.
I could see myself as a follower of Anasurumbur Kellis, the Aspect Emperor of the Three Seas in R. Scott Baker's Second Apocalypse Saga.
okay, I don't know anything about that.
It's pretty rich and deep, and that is one where there are segments in those books where they come back to me. I think about little motifs that he rolls out, and like some of it is as meaningful as any actual religion, actual mythology in my life. Likewise, the Dune universe.
Hey, I am right with you there. In fact, I think some of the liturgical formulas of the Dune universe are absolutely useful in the real world, and you don't have to buy into the reality of Dune at all. I'd say try the litany against fear sometime.
Yeah.
If you are feeling fear, say these words: I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see the path. And where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain.
Yeah, I mean, I have seriously taken some strength and comfort from those words in the past.
Yeah, I mean, they sort of take on the nature of a proverb, right?
Yeah.
Where it's not necessarily, it's not the authority of the text that gives it its power. It's self-evidently powerful. It's a piece of literature that you don't even need to know where it came from in order for it to be effective.
Yeah, exactly. So how about you? What hyper-real religion would you turn to, Joe?
Well, besides that, I do love the litany against fear, but my own personal choice for years was, Facebook used to ask you what your religion is.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well, that's none of your business, Facebook. So I'm going to say Thulsa Doom, right? The Temple of Set from James Earl Jones in the Schwarzenegger Conan the Barbarian movie. I'm to understand Thulsa Doom is kind of different in other media, right?
Yeah. But my opinion is that he gain perfection in that film.
Yeah, James Earl Jones, he's the perfect Thulsa Doom. He's a great villain, but he's a very profound and literary villain.
Yeah, very charismatic.
What is steel compared to the hand that wields it? He has the whole message that flesh is stronger than steel, because steel is just a tool. The flesh is the will.
Mm-hmm.
And I can get behind that. I see what he's getting at.
Yeah, and plus the parties look pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Cannibal stew, giant snakes, and lots of lounging around.
Yeah. Well, one more thing. I mean, I have to admit that there's ever so slight a temptation to some Jediism. I'm not saying I would ever be a Jediist, but I can get a little misty when I think about the fact that luminous beings are we, not this crude matter.
Oh. All right. Well, there you have it. Hyper real religions. Kind of a, an examination of where we are in terms of modern religious faith and fandom, where we've come from, and perhaps a new way to sort of look at these older religions as well. Of course, we want to hear from everyone else out there. Do any of you guys and gals follow a hyper-real religion? Do we have any Unitologists in the audience that want to speak up about Altman?
About Church of the Subgenius.
Yeah, Church of the Subgenius. There are a number of big ones that we didn't even have time to get to in this podcast. So, we would love to hear from any and all of you about that.
And sincerely, if you want to let us know what you truly love about this religion and why you consider it a real faith, please share.
Yeah, do so. We will keep an open mind and encourage everyone else to keep an open mind about it as well. In the meantime, check us out at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is where you will find all the podcasts, the videos, blog posts, links out to our social media accounts. We are Blow the Mind on Facebook and Twitter. We are Stuff to Blow Your Mind on Tumblr.
And if you want to get in touch with us with feedback to this episode or any other recent episode, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.